Wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Johnnata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Johnnata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, reminding you that you too can support this amazing community resource by going to the website at kboo.fm and clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner. On today's show, we continue our exploration of the local, national, and global uprising against police violence and for Black lives. First up, Bill Resnick talks with Greg McKelvey and reflects on policing and the protests locally and nationally, which continue and, as of this weekend, show no signs of diminishing. To find out more about upcoming actions, including neighborhood marches and family-friendly events, you can go to the Portland Black Lives Matter events calendar at pdx-blm-events.org. After we hear from Greg and Bill, Desiree Helligers talks with activist Hyung Nam, who served on the city-appointed Citizens Police Budget Advisory Committee and who organizes with the Portland Metro People's Coalition, which has been working with Unite Oregon, Portland African American Leadership Forum, and folks in other groups to win reductions to the Portland police budget and reinvestment in services needed by marginalized and especially BIPOC communities, and is looking ahead to the negotiations on the police contract and to developing a people's budget. Finally today, our public health duo, Patricia Kullberg and Jan Hocken, take up the Black Panther Party's vision and practice of community-based health care, which the Panthers formulated in the wake of the urban uprisings of the mid-1960s. Our shows are archived on the KBOO website. You can find the posts of weekly shows and individual segments a day or two after broadcast by going to our page at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Those audio posts generally include links to more information about segment topics, so they're worth checking out, even if you don't want to listen to the segment again or send it to your friends. You can also find on our KBOO page the link to subscribe to our show on your podcast listening service, and you can friend or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. If you review and rate us highly on iTunes, we might even become a little easier to find there. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour, all one word, lowercase, at gmail.com if you have questions, comments, or suggestions. We'd love to hear from you. We turn now to Bill Resnick.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole with thoughts about the George Floyd protest here and around the country and the world, and where the struggle for control of the police is heading. What should be the means towards what ends? Recently, I talked to Greg McKelvey, an early leader of Black Lives Matter in Portland, a co-founder of the Portland Resistance. It's been active in the Floyd protest here, as well as in the Police Reform Network, also in Portland. The network supporting a program of vast change in the police union contract with the city. That contract's now being negotiated. The network is providing great community support for the several city commissioners who are fighting for important contract changes, which contract must go beyond the great victories just won before the city council, in fact, just this Thursday. the partial defunding of police, the creation of alternatives to the police as to schools, police, and dealing with the homeless, maybe dealing with mental health emergencies. And also, wonder of wonders, we Portlanders just elected a new district attorney who not only promised a reform agenda, but has fought for it in the past, including with alternatives to incarceration for lots of crimes, including drug crimes. Also today, I'll be summarizing the findings of quite a few interviews I've done over the years on police abolition and alternatives. First, I interviewed Greg McKelvey about a week ago on the uprising in Portland following the murder of George Floyd. Here are some excerpts. So, Greg McKelvey, give us your evaluation of what's happened in the city. Are the protests tapering off now, or are we moving into another phase?
I think we're definitely moving into another phase, but I wouldn't characterize it as tapering off. There are lots of different protests popping up around different parts of the city. Remember, there's neighborhood protests going on and neighborhood family marches. We've seen marches in Clackamas and Lake Oswego, Washington County, Beaverton, and all those things give people more opportunity to go to different things, which of course would then siphon off a few people from the larger crowd. But even just going around the city, you see a lot of people with signs just homemade in their cars for everybody to see. You see a lot of people just holding signs on the sidewalk. So I would say that maybe the main protest might have a few less people, but the uprising is still continuing, and I think will continue into a phase where people are demanding local action. We've already seen the school resource officers be pulled from schools, and that happened after just a week, and so who could say what could happen in the time span of, let's say, a month.
Greg McKelvey and I recorded that over a week ago. Since then, we've seen the protests multiply across the country and world, and they haven't changed much. In that they're almost entirely young people. It hasn't changed us to that. One of my friends, a woman of 56, said in her protest group she didn't see anyone near her age. But the protests have changed a good deal in some respects, in that they've widened their critique and demands and indeed achieved a great success in Portland, as I discussed, and we'll discuss further in partially defunding the police. Getting back to Greg, I asked him, Greg, one very important thing hasn't changed, the multiracial character of the protests and the youthfulness of the protesters. It seems to me that this uprising, of course, directed against police violence, but there's a background of growing anger and critique from young people about inequality, lack of living wage jobs, out of control, climate change that could devastate their lives, and all this as the rich keep getting richer. This anger and fear and demands for change, they seem to have erupted during the protests, which could be a sign of long-lasting rebellion.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we have sort of a powder keg in this country that was just ready to ignite with the pandemic occurring and lots of people experiencing economic insecurity, worried about how they're going to pay rent, if they're going to be evicted. Then you have young people that are incredibly worried about the future of the planet. And we have a president that inflames all racial tensions in an incredibly polarized country that, along with alt-right groups that have been invading our city for a long time. I think the entire country really was ripe for this. So I think the timing really does contribute to the size of the uprising.
Only want to kill what you don't understand. Gay and black, brown or white, tell me this, how much more do you think we're gonna take?
Oh please, it's the place, but don't shoot the man I love. Your engine man can hold that trigger, make it make your ego bigger. Please, it's the place, but don't shoot the man I love. Your
folks. This is KBLO Radio, Portland, Oregon, Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety. On the last near 3 weeks of an uprising after the murder of George Floyd, we just heard riffs from the song Please Mr. Policeman by a whole set of groups and the singer Maurice. We've heard so far parts of an interview with Greg McKelvey done near a week ago, pointing to the vast size, duration of the protests. In fact, it's fast growing across the U.S. and the world, and especially among the young. And while the protests remain true to their initial impetus, that is, challenging police violence and racism, exploitation of people of color, this uprising, it also created fear in national elites because it came to express the anger among the young and many of us others about economic inequality, lack of affordable housing, the numbing precariousness here and growing all around the world as the rich get richer and devastate planetary ecosystems. In the concluding segment of this piece, I'm going to try to present the radical program about what must be done about police violence. That's based on my reading and my interviews over the years with many folks, including Alex Vitale, who wrote the book The End of Policing, Christian Williams, a local, who wrote Our Enemies in Blue, Malik Nia, the black revolutionary activist, and the essayist, too. Also, Greg McKelvey and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Oregon. All these have addressed police violence and how to end it and create a society in which all can contribute and live in dignity. First, what can be done about police violence? What works? It's not the usual stuff. Police cameras don't seem to make a difference, nor does training in community relations, training in tension reduction and cooling people down. Nor does anti-racism training, nor do civilian review boards help much when they are weak and have no control of police behavior or discipline. None appear to reduce targeting and severe violence towards blacks. What then does seem to work, at least to some extent? Well, it's making the police accountable, which starts with the local district attorney. Having a DA that prosecutes illegitimate violence by the police and throughout the criminal justice system, that's crucial. Also, police violence seems to be considerably reduced when policies on the use of force are tightened up and enforced by the police hierarchy themselves and by the district attorneys. Next, there's the police contract that's now being negotiated in Portland, and the struggle is on, where that police contract must permit accountability. After a shooting or any use of extreme violence, the police involved must be immediately interviewed. Not as the practice is today and demanded in many police contracts, including in Portland, 2 or more days afterwards, in which the police on the scene with the police union's lawyers, they collaborate to create their story, to make their defense. And, of course, the dead man was always reaching for a gun. In addition, civilian review boards can have some effect if they have official support and subpoena power, and police discipline files must include all complaints with particulars of the complaint and the outcome. They must be subject to public records inspection with, of course, those restrictions to protect privacy. If these accountability measures are in place, then police cameras and anti-racism and community relations training and training in defusing conflict, so they can all have some positive effect. In addition, of course, all critical observers emphasize radically reducing police numbers, defining much more narrowly police responsibilities, and simultaneously building up social services that deal humanely with what's called public safety problems. We know that many programs can work in dealing with drug use and harm reduction and rehabilitation and incarceration, including drug courts and dealing with mental health emergencies, domestic violence, child protection, and houselessness, and basically in maintaining decent order in the schools, where police have also been increasingly involved. They've been given a huge portfolio. Last week, Thursday, in a Portland City Council budget hearing, which led to a council decision, over 100 people testified. This in the midst, of course, of the great uprising, which was on the minds of all the city council people and, indeed, all politicians and the elites. Over 100 people testified in those hearings over Zoom, demanding a partial defunding of police and use of the money on the helping services I just enumerated. The council agreed to some extent. They reduced the police budget and set aside some monies. That's, of course, a start, and the movements that spearheaded it will surely continue and hold them to account. Of course, still to be decided are issues of police militarization, the police coming to see and encouraged to see the local population as the enemy, with the police becoming, of course, an occupying army. In the end, of course, none of this will succeed. Even altogether, nothing will succeed if the U.S. remains so unequal, precarious, so many people driven to desperation and despair, others to illegal ways of making a living, so many people living on the streets, so many hungry children. And that's in a world whose food and other production could collapse if global roasting continues. Still today, we have reason for some optimism of the real and intellect. In these protests, the uprising, we see a movement developing that could make a difference towards achieving social justice and also towards implementing the Green New Deal and its promise of good contributory work and income and dignity for all. This was Bill Resnick for The Old Mole on KBLO Portland.
Gay and black, brown or white, tell me this. How much more do you think we're gonna take?
I'll clean up the pavement. Don't shoot the flammer. No, you're thinking back. Pull that trigger. Make it right, your ego bigger. Clean up the pavement. Don't shoot the flammer. No, you're a show.
That was Please, Mr. Policeman, again, and before that, Bill Resnick talking with Greg McKelvey last week and reflecting on what kinds of changes we need for genuine public safety. You can find links to Bill's earlier interviews with Alex Vitale, Christian Williams, and Malik Mia when this episode segment is posted, along with a transcript of his remarks and links to more about some ideas for changes to policing and alternatives that would create real public safety. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, your host for today's episode about Portland's not-yet autonomous zone. We turn now to Desiree Helliger's conversation with Hyung Nam of the Portland Metro People's Coalition and their discussion of Thursday's hearing on the Portland Police Bureau budget, the upcoming vote this week, and the movement to defund the Portland Police.
My guest today is Hyung Nam with the Portland Metro People's Coalition, who's also served on the Budget Advisory Committee for the Portland Police Bureau. Hyung, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you fill us in a little bit on what happened on Thursday's vote on the City Council budget?
Yeah, it's a little bit still unclear, and I want to just kind of be careful about not adding to further kind of rumors and confusion. Just because I haven't, the city hasn't posted the amendments, so, and I was listening to everything on KABU, and KABU cut off before the crazy confusion happened. But what we do know is that there was unanimous support for many of the demands that were being made by the community led by Unite Oregon and PALF and many other organizations like PMPC. And that is to cut things that were really difficult to cut in the past. That includes not only the SROs that was already done, school resource officers, the entire gun violence reduction team that is the rebranded gang enforcement task force that was impossible to cut last year. PPB's participation in the TriMet thing, which was kind of going away anyway. 8 positions for the Special Emergency Reactions Team, which is Portland's SWAT team. And divert the cannabis tax that the cops were completely taking that they weren't supposed to do. And so all that adds up to about $15.6 million, unanimous agreement on that as far as I can remember. And on top of the cuts that were happening because of the recession, so that adds up to a total of $27.29 million in cuts to PPB. And that also translates into more than $10 million in reinvestments outside of PPB into everything from Portland Street Response to cannabis social equity grants to tribal liaison to OEHR funding, Black Youth Development Fund, participatory budgeting with the houseless community, and contingencies. So even though we are kind of hung up in the air right now because we needed a unanimous vote yesterday, because of the kind of emergency nature of how these amendments were introduced, because all of this was really, we thought, settled back in May, and it's because of this historic uprising that it opened the door for the possibility of passing anything with new amendments and unanimous votes. So we had unanimous votes in all of this, but the final vote that was needed to approve the entire budget, is, as far as I know, because I didn't hear this part of the hearing, did not happen, with Commissioner Udaly saying that this was not enough and that the community has been asking for $50 million in cuts, and she could not pass this. So that means that on the second reading next week, where we can't introduce any other new amendments, we have a chance to pass the budget. I believe it doesn't have to be unanimous. It could just be even 3 out of 4 votes. And given that there is unanimous consent on these important items to cut from PPB and to reinvest outside of PPB, I'm confident that we can pass those things. But I think it's going to be really important for people to be tactful in trying to repair some of the misunderstandings and tensions and conflicts that came up at the end of yesterday's hearing, to make sure that we can stay firm not only with the things that were agreed upon, that's really important and clear victory for everybody, and to work together for much bigger long-term work of critically examining more of public safety and rethinking it, and completely redesigning and rebuilding public safety and a people's budget in the city.
So we're talking about a total of 27 or 29 million cuts that were agreed upon out of the 50 million that community groups were asking for. And I just want to just do a shout out to an op-ed that appeared in the Oregonian on Friday, and we're actually taping on Friday, by Linda Sen, who's the acting executive director of Sisters of the Road, writing on behalf of Stop the Sweeps PDX, and really speaking to planned escalation of sweeps of houseless encampments in the midst of the pandemic and the PPP's role in that, and talking about the enormous expansion that we're likely to see in houselessness. It's predicted to increase by 40 to 50% by summer. So she is also kicking in to that call to defund the PPP and to shift money to fund housing and other life-affirming resources. So city's police response to houseless people is also very much a consideration here, and the need to transfer funding in that direction as well. So I just wanted to give a shout out to that.
That's really important. We have to remember that we're in a historic recession, and the housing crisis was already just a devastating pre-existing condition. And with the federal moratoriums on evictions and also the extra unemployment all coming to an end very soon, and this recession is really kind of in the early stages, people are going to be devastated, and there are going to be such huge needs for people at every level, and our local governments are going to be strapped, facing austerity. There's no other bureau that we can take funds from. The police bureau is the biggest bureau of all the bureaus in the city, and I think it's really time to start reorienting our public dollars to really serve social needs that policing just only makes worse.
So the PPP budget represents about 40% of the city's general fund budget.
Close to 40% of the general funds.
I'm always grateful to you, Hyung, for your posts on Facebook, because you're always posting really important reads. And one of those, I think today, was the piece from Jacobin by David Sirota, which is talking to the massively disproportionate expansion of police budgets between 1977 and 2017, right? The fact that we had only a 50% population increase in that period, but even adjusting for inflation, we've seen 173% increase in police budgets across the country.
Oh, yeah. I think in general, the overall trend on how much social spending is especially on things like public assistance has gone down over the years and how much our spending on policing and incarceration has gone up. It is just a completely irrational system. If you were a fiscal conservative, you would look at this and just think how crazy and wasteful all of this is. And we externalize these costs. I mean, anytime we use policing to try to address issues that are social economic issues that need to be addressed, it only externalizes the costs. I mean, a cost for jailing to the county, cost for incarceration to the state, on top of just devastating people's lives.
Yeah, and I think that sort of speaks to the relationship to the arc of neoliberalism and defunding and privatization and deregulation. And it's really that same window of time where we've seen these massive cuts to the social safety net and the transfer of funding to basically militarized policing.
Absolutely.
The links, I think, to racism and white supremacy come across really clearly in that as well. So Michelle Alexander talks about, you know, you see that massive backlash to the gains of the civil rights movement and the transfer of funding to basically just mass incarceration of people of color and massive spike in policing communities of color.
And on top of that, too, you know, it's really the political economy. As we know that African-Americans especially basically live under recession conditions during good economic times. Their unemployment rates because of discrimination are always double that for whites and Asians. And during times of recession, when it doubles for recession levels of unemployment for anyone else, it is just devastating. So in this neoliberal period, with outsourcing of jobs, loss of manufacturing jobs, African Americans were always the first to be laid off, you know, last to be hired, first to be laid off, and really kind of become in our capitalist political economy kind of a surplus population that there was no place for. So the carceral system creates a place for them. Again, it's an incredible waste of our public resources to, you know, have incarceration and policing increase so much, but certain people have jobs that way and make money that way. And that is the dysfunctional, or I shouldn't say dysfunctional, it functions for certain people and the ruling class. And that is the system that we have today. I think more and more people recognize how wrong policing is. I think it's also really important to think about, you know, what budgets can be and what cities can do, and talk about the idea of a people's budget and this kind of work that's being done all over the country right now. Until we get to the point where we've completely disbanded policing, our police, and rebuilt a very different kind of public safety, it's going to take some time. But until that happens, it's really important that we hold policing officers accountable for misconduct, especially with deadly force, use of deadly force, and racism. And one way of doing that is making changes to the police contract. And there's a lot that we and organizations and especially other unions can do in weighing in on this and getting the city to really change the way that it negotiates a police contract with the Portland Police Association.
Mm-hmm. And certainly there's calls also for just basically decertifying police union.
Absolutely, yeah. And there are so many other kind of things. One other item that's outside of the police budget is, you know, not only their retirement, and but also liability. This is actually in the budget of the Office of Management and Finance. If you pay attention to city council agenda almost any week, you'll always notice these little items for settlements that happen for some of its, you know, police vehicle accidents or whatever. But one of the top items is police misconduct with use of force. And so that's paid not from the police budget, but from another bureau budget, the Office of Management and Finance. So if we really add up all the hidden costs of legal fees representing police officers to the insurance and so on, it is an enormous amount of money that we waste on policing that does really nothing to solve any kind of social economic problems, and that really traumatize people and cause even more problems for us in the future.
Yeah, can I just say that one of the most sort of dramatic instances I've seen in the last 24 hours of police causing problems is the video that's making the rounds now of the police throwing a flashbang grenade. I think it happened on the 29th, when the street actions were just beginning to unfold. And, you know, the whole narrative was about protesters setting a car on fire and all the rest of it. It turns out it was a police flashbang grenade that went, rolled under a car and set it on fire. And alongside the fact that another live undeployed police grenade was just left in the street.
It's just incredible. You know, like I said in my testimony, everything from Assistant Chief Davis insisting on using CS gas during this pandemic that can just vastly exacerbate COVID-19 to this study that I only recently discovered that was done after Ferguson about militarized policing. It's the New Directions in Protest Policing study. And the study concluded that police dress for war and only inflame violence and jeopardize their own safety and that of the public. And I think we see all over the country, including here in Portland. And really, I want to say that this is not just about the cops. It's really about who's supposed to be in control of the cops. And that's the mayor as well.
You know, there's just one other connection that I wanted to make, which is, I think you started out by saying, really, the extent to which all this street action and all the protests are really pushing this agenda forward. And the fact that Opal Environmental Justice was, you know, working also to get the police removed from the fare check. And that that also, you know, a lot of these issues also really impact undocumented people, because that TriMet policing is one of the ways in which sort of gauntlets are set up. And that's absolutely terrifying to undocumented people, whether they end up in the system or not. So a lot of this really does impact undocumented communities as well.
Absolutely. Many cities, including Portland, before all of this happened, had already been thinking about making transit completely free. And Opal's done some fantastic work pushing that. And instead of the money, so much money going to policing for fares, we can put that money and basically have free public transit. And granted that it would cost a bit more than just the cost of fare policing to make public transit free, but in some places it really kind of balances out. But it's just another example of how fiscally unconservative these normal kinds of policies are. It's completely wasteful.
I just want to note, too, that connection to free public transit and how important that is for communities of color that have been displaced from the inner core of Portland all the way out, right? And so now they're bearing that additional cost of transportation on a daily basis. So in terms of making, you know, some start on reparations to communities of color, that's a really important development.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, whether it's transportation or policing in general, it's not by accident. Just like what the Students for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee did in the 60s with power mapping, looking at why is this happening and who's behind it, right? When we say that the police protect and serve, they don't protect and serve the public. They protect and serve the ruling class. And that means the whitest and the richest people, and not just people, corporations and businesses. That's whose interest they work for. And in that way, it's efficient and functional for them. It's incredibly wasteful and dysfunctional for everyone else.
Yes, absolutely. Can you also maybe just tell us really quickly what kind of action steps people can take between now and Wednesday, which is when the revote is likely to occur?
I think it's important for the heat on the streets to continue, because that's what's opened up these doors. But we also have to go through that door and have these dialogues with very clear demands and give them a chance to step up to this moment and recognize that this is a truly historic moment. And we all need hope so much right now. We have a chance of doing something transformational and going in such a different direction. And I really hope we can do that.
We need that heat in the streets, and we need the dialogue too. So thank you, Hyung Nam. My guest today has been Hyung Nam. Thank you so much for joining me today. He is a member of the Portland True People's Coalition and has served as on the Budget Advisory Committee for the Portland Police Bureau. Thank you so much, Hyung.
This has been Desiree Hollegers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
What happens when you call the cops? Say what? This is what happens when you call the cops.
Come on.
This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. You get your rights violated or you all get shot.
I'm sick of people being victimized by criminal cops. Psychopathic predators terrorizing neighborhood blocks. Equipped with pepper spray, mace, cuffs, tasers, and glocks. They like serial killers acting out subliminal
thoughts. Forget what you taught. These cops have got a license to kill. Witness intimidation means that they can use it at will. Code of silence means that the pigs will never let out a squeal. And if they go to court, they know the judge will make them a deal. For real, that's why they stopping me, locking me up and stopping me, confiscating my property, talking in my demography, making the poor commodities, profiting off of poverty, enforcing policies, supporting prison economies. Yeah, no one makes money when the violence stops. Hating brutality is the way to make a criminal cry. Blood in the gutters, how the rich butter they bread at the top. And that's why this is what happens when you call the cops. Come on.
This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops. This is what happens when you call the cops.
That was a little of Rob Hussle telling us about what happens when you call the cops. And before that, Desiree Helligers talking with Hyung Nam of the Portland Metro People's Coalition about better places to spend the city's money than on the police. Hyung is also a teacher and a member of the Portland Association of Teachers and of Jobs with Justice. And if you're a union member interested in finding out more about this whole defund the police movement, keep an eye out for an event they have coming up from Jobs with Justice for union members to find out more about what it means and how to engage with it. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. Hyung Nam mentioned the lessons to be learned from the work of the
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee
back in the 60s. And our public health segment today looks at lessons and legacy from the Black Panther Party and their community health program.
This is Jan Hawken and Patricia Kohlberg with our second segment on public health and the pandemic. As the mass movement against police brutality continues, many commentators compare this period of radical possibilities to the 1960s. We are now seeing a broad multiracial anti-policing movement, and this wave of activism invites a certain kind of recovery of social memory of these earlier periods of resistance and reflection on what we can learn from them. The Black Panthers have become iconic in representing the 1960s and occupy a powerful place in the American social imaginary. Known for armed resistance to the police, the Black Panthers were also highly conscious that the problem of police brutality was deeply intertwined with other forms of inequality. Patricia, part of your medical and public health training involved drawing on that community model of healthcare. Can you tell us about it?
Good morning, Jan. It's great to be here with you again. Yes, when I was in my training in the late 70s, 80s, and then doing a master's in public health, I did my thesis on the community health center movement of the 60s and 70s. I was quite taken with the ideas and the practice that came out of that movement. And I found particularly interesting the ideas and the program of the Black Panthers, because I think that they were part of that movement, but they took their ideas and their practice in a further radical direction.
Now, when you say they were part of that movement, you mean a broader Black Power movement and also the Free Clinic movement. There were a lot of intersecting movements, some of which involved re-envisioning community.
Exactly. And they started with developing free community health care centers because they saw the main problem initially was that Black folks simply weren't getting access to mainstream medical care. So they developed a network of clinics, what they called People's Free Health Clinics, all of them in urban centers. And in fact, there was one here in Portland called the Fred Hampton People's Free Health Clinic. And the idea behind those clinics was that they would be providing individual care. And they couldn't provide comprehensive primary care, but they did provide screening for hypertension, TB, lead poisoning, diabetes, they provided immunizations, that kind of personal care. But they also did that in a way that honored the knowledge and health practices of those communities. And part of their program was, for example, to teach patients about their health so that they could go into the white mainstream medical establishment and do a better job of advocating for themselves, of understanding what was going on in those medical encounters. Their whole program was to empower people around their own healthcare needs.
In our last segment, we talked some about the distinction between the medical model and the public health model. And can you speak again to that distinction?
So in contrast to a medical care model, which is really about providing individual care, the project of public health is to create the conditions that enable people to live the longest and healthiest lives possible. And at the root of a public health practice is to recognize patterns of morbidity and mortality within the community, and then to investigate the root causes of those patterns of disease, and then formulate and advocate for solutions to prevent those problems. And what the Black Panthers understood right away, of course, is that the poor health that the Black community so often suffered in terms of higher rates of diabetes and heart disease and stroke and asthma, that those were inextricably linked to poverty and racism. And they were among the earliest to understand and elaborate those ideas around what we now call the social determinants of health and also the racial disparities in health, where you find that communities of color suffer a much larger burden of disease.
There's also an aspect of the medical model that emphasizes expertise in dispensing medical or healthcare knowledge or services, and a lot of the movements, the healthcare movements of that period, emphasized expertise that emerges from community, challenged hierarchical models of healthcare where the physicians are the top, the head of the team, and other people take directions from them. As a former nurse, I can yes. I lived through some of that history. But the social change model that you're including here is also one that draws on the experiences of people, not just dispensing services to people on the margins, that rather than a model of oppressed people simply being devoid of resources, having to be filled up by the dominant and privileged groups, it's one that also involves forms of knowledge and resiliency. And
their project was to leverage the particular strengths and knowledge of those communities that they were serving, and also to bring those folks into the care model so that the people who were working in the clinic were people who were also living in those communities. And the folks who were working in the clinics would also do outreach, and they would be doing that in their own neighborhoods. And so they had a very intimate knowledge of what those communities were like and where they could take advantage of people's indigenous kinds of knowledge. And there's a very long history of African Americans taking care of their own communities because they have been so long excluded from the mainstream healthcare system.
I remember when I was working as a registered nurse in a hospital, a couple of hospitals in the late 70s in Los Angeles, there would be a racially stratified hierarchy of professions. Do you know how much that model of care challenged that hierarchy?
It did to some degree. There were not a lot of Blacks who had already gone to medical school or nursing school at that time, but then they did pull in some Black health professionals into their community health centers. But there were also a lot of white physicians and nurses who volunteered at those clinics. Coming out of the Black Panthers health clinics, a lot of people got their start in their healthcare profession by first volunteering so that following the development of these clinics, you saw a lot more African-American men and women entering medical school or nursing school. So it spawned a whole generation of Black health professionals.
Patricia, you were talking earlier about some of the public health practices of the Black Panthers and the community mental health model of that period. Can you give some other examples of that?
There are a couple of very interesting ones. I think the one that most people have possibly heard about is around sickle cell screening. Sickle cell anemia is a genetic disease that affects almost exclusively the Black population. And because of that, there was virtually no interest in the mainstream medical establishment to do research on or investigate in any way sickle cell anemia. And people weren't even necessarily getting diagnosed. So they started a widespread national testing program, and they ended up screening, I believe, 30,000 people for sickle cell anemia, and at the same time started making demands that there be funding toward this disease. That agitation eventually resulted in legislation in the early 70s, I believe, that Nixon signed to provide funding for sickle cell anemia. Another part of the Black Panther public health practice was to protect Black communities from becoming victims of medical experimentation. There is a long history of that in this country, and people are probably familiar with the Tuskegee syphilis study that went on for four decades, in which Black, mostly Black men who had syphilis were left untreated in order for investigators to follow the natural course of the illness.
Even though penicillin had already been identified as an effective treatment for syphilis.
That's correct. It was identified after the study was started, but they did not disband the study to then treat everyone. They just continued the study. It was a gross violation of the ethical practice of research. And African Americans have a very deep memory of this. And so part of the Black Panthers project was to prevent that kind of thing from happening. And in 1973, they organized to block the creation of a UCLA Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence, which had among its proposals an experimental brain surgery that was going to remedy aggression. Of course, the people who were going to be getting this experimental brain surgery were going to be Black and brown men in prison. So this was a race-based theory of violence. It was a biomedical model of violence that locates violence in a mental aberration or a mental condition within the individual who is then needs to be controlled because they're dangerous and they're deviant.
Which is horrifying to think about how what's considered acceptable practice at one time and then is universally rejected as unethical and bad practice comes out of social movements making such declarations.
Well, they successfully organized against this project, and one of the interesting little anecdotes shutting down that project was that one of the Panthers ended up delivering an address in the California State Legislature that elaborated how violence was rooted in capitalism, in imperialism, materialism, and racism, rather than something that is located in the defects of Black and brown bodies. They were creating a whole new narrative about not only disease, but about how medicine was used to create narratives about social problems that ignored the social conditions that caused those problems.
And it has its parallel in what counts as a crime, you know, what constitutes criminality or crime, and who decides what behaviors are or are not crimes. And there's a parallel in medicine in terms of what counts as a disease or a disorder and who decides.
And there's always been, and there still is, that tendency to medicalize social problems.
And by medicalize, it separates pathologies from some idealized sphere of normalcy, and the model is to bring the disease under control, but a very narrow focus on the broader context that
gives. Right, so a very individual, technical kind of approach that allows society to ignore the actual root causes of those problems.
So there's a lot to be learned from that period, and perhaps the lessons too we could return to in another segment on why the public health model and the lessons of social change and medicine from the Black Power movement of that period have been so difficult to integrate into the healthcare system we have.
Well, I think it's been suppressed. I think that history has been suppressed because it presents a direct challenge to the existing social structure. I mean, public health at its root, and the Black Panthers understood this very well, is at its root a very radical notion that what ails us inheres in the way that we construct our society. The powers that be don't want to hear that.
So perhaps it's somewhat like reclaiming the commons, reclaiming healthcare as a public good, and in a much broader way that goes beyond just simply access to the doctor of your choice.
So, exactly, and my hope is that part of what comes out of this current uprising is not just police reform or restructuring of police, as important as that is, but I hope that it expands into a broader vision of how we can make our communities healthy and how we can apply those lessons from community health care and public health from the 60s to our current situation and build a much healthier, more inclusive, and more humane society.
That's more life-sustaining in so many ways. Yeah, this has been Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg today talking about public health and the pandemic and what we can learn from the Black Panther movement for public health.
To get us locked up, shut up and back in chain. Who denies the future? Call my name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me. The lady liberties and hypocrisy, she rocks on me. Promise for freedom, education, equality.
That was a bit of Tupac Shakur's Panther Power, one of the first solo tracks he ever recorded, and his tribute to the Black Panthers and his mother, Afeni Shakur, who was herself a Black Panther. Before that, we heard Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken discussing the Black Panther Party's community health program, including Portland's own Fred Hampton Clinic and the problems with the medical industry that have made that community care all the more necessary. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thanks to Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg, to Desiree Heligers and Hyung Nam, and Bill Resnick and Greg McKelvey. Thanks also to John Nielsen for help with editing. And thanks to you, KBOO listeners and members.